Welcome, and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Insight International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in KPMG's Washington National Tax International Tax Practice. I'm joined by my co-host, Gary Scanlon, a principal in the same group. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Kristen.
So we're excited to have Tom Szolo with us today. Tom is a principal in KPMG's Washington National Tax Practice and is widely recognized for his expertise in transfer pricing and international tax structuring. This episode is particularly special as Tom will be retiring from the firm as of September 30th. In honor of his distinguished career, today we'll be reflecting on his professional journey, discussing some of the key moments that have shaped his path, and hearing his thoughts on the future of tax. We'll also ask Tom to share his advice for tax professionals working in this dynamic field. Welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm really excited to have you back, Tom. I was just looking back at our podcast website, and you were here way back on March 22nd, 2021 for our first ever podcast, IP, Where Art Thou? Fantastic name based on a fantastic movie. So Tom is the OG podcast guest for Inside International Tax. And now we're doing a slightly different format here where this is just going to be an interview and we're going to explore the depths of Tom's mind and Tom's experience. So Tom, let's start. Tell us about your background. You can start as far back as you want, maybe at least after your birth. Where did you go to school? How did you get into tax?
Sure. Well, I won't go as far back as birth, Gary, but the path to tax is a long and strange one. I don't think anybody starts out as a 12-year-old thinking they want to be a tax lawyer. So it really started when I thought about becoming a lawyer. And that was when I was in high school. My uncle Ned was a New York State Assemblyman. His son, my cousin Jack, was a prosecutor in the Syracuse area. And I thought that what they were doing was interesting, and I had an interest in the law. So when I went to college, I was consciously pre-law. I majored in economics, which I didn't necessarily plan on doing when I entered college, but I took an interest in economics when I took my first microeconomics class. I graduated from Columbia with a degree in economics and then went straight to Harvard Law School. Before I entered law school, my last 2 years in college, I lived with a Columbia law student. He came back to our apartment, you know, one day and was talking about a tax class he was taking with a professor, Martin Ginsburg. And he was telling me how interesting and funny and intelligent Professor Ginsburg was. And I attended one of his classes with him, and I was taken with Marty as well. And that got me thinking that maybe tax law was something worth thinking about. And my second and third years at Harvard Law School, I took the tax classes that were available. I think I was in Stanley Suri's final tax seminar that he gave at Harvard. And I was determined then that when I started the practice of law, I would go into tax, which happened. I went to my second year in law school. I worked in New York City, but I became engaged in law school. My wife was from Chicago. We agreed to locate there. And I interviewed with Kirkland and Ellis. And one of the people I interviewed with was Jack Levin. And many of the people listening to this probably are familiar with the Ginsburg and Levin treatise. And Jack asked the question, how did I get interested in tax law? And I related the story about Marty Ginsburg's class. And his eyes lit up. I did not know that they were best friends at the time. But I think my interview with Jack ended around noon. By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the recruiting head at Kirkland had called me with an offer. So kind of the rest is history. When I joined Kirkland, I went right into the tax department. I've been practicing tax ever since.
Funny you should mention no 12-year-old wants to be a lawyer. I actually wanted to be an accountant when I was 12 years old. I thought at the time that accountancy just involved counting. I was a very dull child, but that's great. Marty Ginsburg, I did not know, but I remember reading the foreword to his great treatise in which he explained that he had moved to D.C. for his wife's job. I'd never put it together that he was the husband of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He clearly had a very dry sense of humor. He seemed like a great guy. What sparked your interest in international tax specifically? Did you start doing international tax at Kirkland, or what led you to it?
No, the Kirkland practice was a very varied practice. So associates worked on a variety of things. Early in my career, this was before the passive activity loss rules, I worked on fund formation, so learned a lot of subchapter K. A lot of the work was private equity or other corporate transactions, so there was subchapter C. But because I had majored in economics as an undergrad, I was recruited to work on two transfer pricing cases early on with Mel Laidis and Jim Mogul, who both specialized in international tax. And those cases were a lot of what I worked on my first 5 years or so at Kirkland.
So you did a lot of transfer pricing there or just those two cases?
Well, just those two cases. Jim later went to an auto manufacturer in Detroit as the chief tax officer, and they had some rather large transfer pricing cases. I worked on those as well. But after 10 years in Chicago, I went to the New York office of Kirkland. Okay. And during that time, virtually everything I worked on was either fund formation or venture capital transactions. Some of them had an international component, but not all of them. The way I got back into international tax really was through KPMG. On the transfer pricing cases, I had worked with Dick Boykin, who was KPMG's senior economist at the time. And KPMG was interested in hiring people from law firms. And various leaders in the firm were asked to put together a list of lawyers that the firm should be targeting, and Dick put me on his list. Kind of coincidentally, one of the first two transfer pricing cases I worked on when I was at Kirkland was with Saul Caseman, who was a senior international partner in Chicago. And so when I was recruited by Jeff Lesage to come into the international group, although they would have been happy for me to join M&A or some other practice, but I selected international. And it's really after I got to KPMG that that became my focus.
So that was in, what, 1999 that you came over to KPMG?
July of 99, yes.
Yeah. Well, what was attractive to you to come to KPMG?
Well, a number of things. First, I wanted to get back to Chicago, and the offer was to go wherever I wanted. Second, I had worked through the years with partners from KPMG, so not just Dick and Saul, but other partners in the Chicago office. And I was very comfortable with them personally. I thought it would be a good atmosphere. And the offer was an attractive one. I had kind of grown tired of doing repetitive private equity transactions. And I always had enjoyed working with in-house tax departments where the client themselves were tax professionals. I found more enjoyment in having those discussions than working with the business people or the deal people at private equity firms. Those were really the motivations for joining KPMG.
The work here at KPMG is never tedious, always interesting and challenging and hard. So now you do mostly IP supply chain restructuring. And tell us about your practice here or what it's been and how it's evolved since
sure.
you got here.
When I think about international tax, there are some rules that are strictly legal. So think about international restructuring and qualifying under various reorganization rules. And then there are tax issues that are softer. Sometimes if a company complies with all the technical rules, tax authorities, if they think they're losing tax base, will turn to transfer pricing, for example, or substance issues, and try to retain their tax base by making assertions under those provisions. You also have questions about how you can change the operations of a business so that they are aligned with the tax model that you're setting up. So you have an intersection of technical tax rules, economics, and business planning, HR planning, all in one type of project. And I found that interesting because it's not just reading through the statutes and regulations. It also involves thinking about how controversies will play out, what kind of economic arguments you can make, and quite frankly, what people are willing to do in the medium to long term to support a structure.
I think that's always what's made you so valuable, Tom, is you have a practical perspective and not just a technical perspective. What I've always gotten from you is very, I'm going to use the word practical again, but something focused more on the economics and the legal realities as opposed to just code and regs. So that's been really valuable. What has changed in your practice, or has anything changed in your practice over this, what, 25, 26 years since you joined KPMG?
The sophistication of tax authorities has changed. The sophistication of OECD rules have changed. And obviously the U.S. tax laws have changed. So, you know, if you go all the way back to the early 2000s, pre-BEPS, we were pre these notions of having Dempy substance in entities. The ability to get tax arbitrage was much greater. We had a corporate tax rate of 35% in the United States, and there were structures where you could move income into zero taxed environments, right? So we're all familiar with the old double Dutch structures or CVBVs, double Irish structures. So the opportunities for arbitrage and the appetite for many taxpayers to take advantage of those aspects of the tax law were considerable then. I think tax authorities, in order to preserve their tax base, got much more sophisticated. We had rules that were brought in dealing with substance, including the tax havens, essentially removing themselves from the competition to be locations for intellectual property. And we had changes in the tax law. It's like about, you know, 2017, reducing the headline rate in the United States from 35 to 21 and instituting the GILTI regime. So every tax authority around the world has gotten more sophisticated, and they've gotten better at applying transfer pricing and other rules to try to preserve their tax base.
What do you think was the biggest change? I mean, legislatively, did the TCJA change your practice dramatically?
It did. The changes came in layers. So going back to around 2009, 2010, the cost-sharing regulations were changed. They were tightened up. We had, in subpart F, the substantial contribution regulations were issued. Then we had BEPS 1.0, and those brought changes in the OECD transfer pricing guidelines. And we had the 2017 Act, and most recently, we've obviously had another act. So all of those changed the rules of the road. And I think that they have caused companies to be far more cognizant of the business aspects of any restructurings that they get into. And they've also caused companies to try to look around the corner and ask, what's coming next? How do I not only adopt a structure that's good today, but will it be sustainable in a way that's consistent with my business model out into the future?
Boy, that question of what happens next seems to be getting harder and harder. I mean, maybe this is just a present bias, but do you think that the changes are coming more fast and furious than they did in the past? It seems like every year we're...
Well, they certainly seem to be, Gary. Also, as I get older, my perception of time tends to change. When I was 25, looking back 8 years, would have seemed like forever. Now, 2017 seems like it was yesterday. So when we talk about OB3, it seems like it occurred very quickly, right, after the 17 Act. But in fact, there was 8 years separating them. You look at the OECD changes or potential changes. We sit here today and nobody can really say what the outcome is going to be on all of BEPS 2.0, particularly the Pillar 2 rules. You need to take into account various outcomes that you might see in the future.
Just legislatively, now that everything gets passed through reconciliation, which you need a simple majority, it seems like whoever takes the House and the Senate and the presidency, which seems to go hand in hand more often than not these days, can change tax policy. And then what's coming out of the OECD seems to be more and more important all the time.
Tom, obviously you've had a very long and distinguished career and seen a lot of tax changes throughout your time practicing. What are your thoughts on OB3 and how that changes the international tax landscape?
There are a number of things going on concurrently. From the 17 Act, which I thought were more sweeping changes, all of us became aware that we could no longer intuitively determine whether a particular strategy was beneficial. So much of it was based upon a taxpayer's tax profile and business that they're in, their profit margins, their projections, and so on. And OB3 changed the rules in a way that tilts some of those considerations in one direction or another. But we still see that modeling is very important. What remains to be seen is how much of a role, as AI becomes more sophisticated, it will play as a tool in allowing tax planners to come up with bespoke solutions that are customized for particular taxpayers. Clearly, OB3 has made now the FIDE regime more attractive and made the tested income regime slightly less attractive, but it didn't provide the same fundamental changes that the 17 Act did. Another issue, since I raised AI, is people are probably thinking, well, is it just a tool that will make me more effective, or is it a tool that will cause me to become obsolete? And I think back to the beginning of my career, one of the things that we did my first year at Harvard Law School was to pull books off a shelf and learn how to shepherdize and find leads into other case law. And even during my early years at Kirkland, although we had Lexis, there was a specialized terminal. You didn't access it through a laptop. We didn't have laptops. And you kind of had to wait your turn, and you still spend all day in the library doing research that I could do right now in 15 or 20 minutes from my home office. And you might ask, did that cause tax lawyers to become more expendable? And the answer is, well, no, right? It was a tool that I think facilitated our practice. It raised the state of play. And one thing I've learned is that you have to constantly retool yourself and raise the level of your game in order to stay relevant. You know, I mentioned earlier that when I started out, I was doing a fair amount of fund formation. A lot of those were syndications of real estate and other assets for individuals who were buying in. And those structures were eliminated when the passive activity loss rules came into the code. And I took what I learned from those, which were a lot of the principles of subchapter K. Those became useful later on when I was working on real estate funds or private equity funds with largely institutional investors. So those tools were still relevant. I just had to apply them in a different context. And you learn a set of international rules. Largely the ones I learned were the rules that prevailed from 1962 through 2017, right? And then we all spent a lot of time in 2017, 2018, up to today, learning all the nuances of the changes in rules. It's going to continue. You're constantly going to have to learn. You're going to continue to apply old things that you knew in new contexts. But, you know, it's got to be a lifelong experience. When you reach the point where you're no longer willing to read regulations, you know, when they come out because you've become bored, I think it's time to think about retirement.
That's a good point, especially in the last few years that we've seen so much change, and things are obviously continuing to change with OB3 and sort of developments at the OECD, as you mentioned. Clearly, some of your advice is that young tax lawyers just need to stay ahead of the game and be flexible and adjust as new rules come out. But is there any other practical advice that you would give the young Tom Zolo starting out his career, or sort of other young tax professionals as they're beginning their journey into international tax?
Yeah. So I mentioned that I had a broad experience that I worked on subchapter K and subchapter C. And I think that that's very helpful. So some of the international strategies that I've implemented, I mean, we all know that international restructuring involves subchapter C, but also international partnerships. I think what I learned in my early years as a lawyer, you know, really getting familiar with all the subchapter K concepts was helpful. Gary raised earlier the practicality of some of the advice that I get. I got that out of working on tax controversies. One thing that many tax professionals in-house and at the accounting firms fall into is this question about whether a transaction more likely than not works under the law. And can I book a benefit or can't I book a benefit? And one thing I learned in controversy is that the actual resolution of issues is never that neat. That frequently, you know, they are negotiated out and there's not a complete victory on either side. Often the discussion shifts from perhaps what the field agent originally raised, which may be, for example, saying that an item of income is subpart F income, to a way of splitting the baby where you say, well, the transfer pricing was wrong and now we're going to look at it from that perspective and think about what kind of settlement is appropriate. I'm also thinking about one docketed case that I had in tax court, which was a small reorganization. And the taxpayer really had gone up to like the limits of what the case law would have permitted in terms of continuity of interest. It was well below the IRS's ruling guideline or safe harbor. And we got up to the point where we were about ready to go to court and the district counsel blinked. And they blinked because the dollars involved were relatively small. But if the taxpayer had won, the principal would have applied potentially to much larger transactions. And it was just a better use of their discretion to concede that case. So I think you need to think about the practicalities of how people are going to behave when they're faced with the risk of really going forward and trying to litigate. And the other thing that I've learned is that there's not one consistent standard for the result you're going to get. That the IRS is populated with people and foreign tax authorities are populated with people. And often the result that you get depends upon the personalities involved and what you're able to negotiate is acceptable to all the sides. And that understanding procedural options is important because often escaping an unfriendly forum and going to a friendlier one is what gets your client a better result. Having had experience that allows me to understand how issues are likely to play out if and when challenged has allowed me to go beyond just the, I think this is a more likely than not issue or not a more likely than not issue, to assessing what the practical outcome is likely to be for a client.
Thanks, Tom, for joining us today to share a little bit about your career and thoughts on the development and future of tax. We wish Tom all the best in his upcoming retirement. His contributions to KPMG and the tax profession in general have been truly valuable. Personally, I will miss Tom, his tax advice, but also his good humor. We also want to give a shout out to Matt O'Neill for all his work behind the scenes on this episode. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.